Welcome to another show of The Brand Called You. Today, I bring you a very close friend and one of the most legendary educational administrators currently in India, Bob Hetzel. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ashutosh.
Bob has been a director of the Cairo American College, and till a few years ago, he was director of the American Embassy School, which has always been rated as the top, amongst the top three international schools in the world. Mm-hmm. Bob, tell us a little bit about your early career, your early learnings, and your challenges.
Well, like most administrators in the American system, I started out as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I taught for a few years, and then I became a principal, and then an assistant superintendent, and a superintendent, which is comparable to being a school director. Mm-hmm. A story I wanted to share, really how I got an education, was... I'm from a rather humble background. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., we call a blue-collar family. Mm-hmm. My mother only completed class 8, and my father worked in a factory. And he took me aside one time when I was a young teenager and said, Bob, I only want two things for you. He said, always be a gentleman, and I want you to get a job where you can wear a white shirt and tie.
Wow.
And for me, education was the route to that. Mm-hmm. And so from the time I was a teenager, I wanted to be a teacher. And school was mm-hmm. was a good place for me. I was successful academically. I loved sports and played all the sports. And so school was a place I looked forward to going to every day. And so I carried that into my career, that I wanted to be a teacher and an educator. I wanted to have a classroom where children wanted to come every day. Mm-hmm. When I became a principal, I said, I want to be a principal that has a school where teachers and parents and kids want to come every day. And it's sort of been the primary motivation mm-hmm. for me in my work.
Amazing. Amazing. And, you know, you did your early education in the U.S., then you worked in the U.S., and then you moved to Asia. Mm-hmm. What was the attraction that brought you to Asia?
Well, really, my right out of college, my first 2 years out of college, I was in a program in the U.S. called the Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. So I lived in, I did community development work in Guatemala. And I might add, that was the first time flying to Guatemala I'd ever been in an airplane. Mm-hmm. And I'd always wanted to, again, go and live and work in another culture. And so I'd been in the public schools in the United States for quite a few years. And I said, I better do it now or it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I applied for the first job that I saw available, which was in Cairo. Mm-hmm. And I went to Cairo. I was successful in getting that position. I stayed 5 years, and I said, I'd like to go to at least one more country. And the first opening that I saw was India.
Okay.
And I knew nothing of India.
Right.
And so I came to India with mm-hmm. the idea of staying 3 to 5 years, which is a typical tenure for mm-hmm. an international administrator. And as you know, now I'm in year 18
I know.
In India.
I know.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was my next question, that, you know, you've almost chosen India to be home.
I have chosen India to be home.
You know, and you spend a lot of time in India. You go back a few times. What attracted you to India?
Well, you know, as
I know you also have learning Hindi.
Yes, with great difficulty. Mm-hmm. You know, I read once that India is not so much a place as it is an experience. Mm-hmm. And that's what charmed me is. I got here and had no idea of how diverse India was, mm-hmm. how vibrant India was, and how unpredictable living in India can be.
Correct.
And all those things, and that combined with the fact I had this wonderful job in an amazing school, top-notch professionals, making wonderful friends, and it just year after year after year after year passed. And finally, I said, you know, I can't think of a good reason not to call this home.
Okay. That's fascinating. So let's move on to your incredible journey with the American Embassy School. Mm. When you came, it must have been a much smaller school, and
yes.
I know you built it. What were some of your challenges and learnings as you built AES?
Well, my predecessor had a difficult time there. And so one of the first challenges was regaining the trust of the community and the faculty that had felt, I think, somewhat disappointed in what had happened in the previous 3 years. So that was probably the greatest challenge. And then the second was working out the relationship with the American Embassy, because the AES has a very unique relationship with the embassy, unlike any other school in the world. And so I needed to understand that. And then it's like any organization, you have a need to grow, and at the same time, you want to grow at a rate that allows you not to forsake quality. And so it's managing the benefits of growth, which are additional resources, a more diverse school community which we value, mm-hmm. and at the same time to do that without overwhelming the institution, and maintaining that quality. You can't, and the quality ultimately rests in the quality of your faculty, mm-hmm. and there's a limit to how many really top-notch quality teachers are out there. So you want to make sure you grow at a rate where you aren't suddenly having to have to settle for somebody as opposed to finding someone really good.
Very interesting. You know, everyone who has worked with you, including my wife, Vera, they just can't stop talking of what an incredible human being manager you are. What is it that you do so differently that people love you so much?
Well, it's very nice of you to say that, and for Vera to say that. You know, I think what I've learned is the two key ingredients to me are trust and caring. And I read a definition of trust one time that trust is unquestionable dependability. That no matter what the situation, you can trust that I'm going to respond appropriately, mm-hmm. that there you can trust in me to treat you respectfully and with care. And caring for me is really how you use your resources. To a great degree, it's mm-hmm. not so much what I say, but what I do. Mm-hmm. People are going to watch what you do. And I think the greatest resource that we have is our time. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the finest compliments I've ever received in my career was a teacher who wrote on a survey I sent out, an anonymous survey, mm-hmm. and the teacher said, "When I'm with Bob Hetzel, I feel like the most important person in the world, and for that moment to him, I am." And so for me, it was being accessible to people. And when I was with them, I truly was with them. I wasn't thinking about what I was going to say. I was really listening to what they were saying and trying to understand. And I think people appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing for me is the whole notion of, it's kind of like the golden rule that's mm-hmm. found in every religion. Treat others as you would like to be treated. And I've always found that if I treated professionals as professionals, mm-hmm. and I respected their competency, their dedication, they were competent and dedicated. Mm, and if I treated them differently, I think they would act differently.
And I've often heard some of your former colleagues say that you make them feel 10 feet tall. It's probably because of the trust and confidence you have in them.
Yeah, and I think there's also, I have a belief in the collective intelligence and the collective creativity. And so I sincerely respect and want to hear people's thinking on issues. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us feel valued when someone asks us our opinions. Mm-hmm. Like today, I mean, this is making me feel so good that you're interested in what I have to say. And my experience with parents and students and teachers, yeah. So when I ask them what they think about something that's important to all of us, it validates their intelligence, it validates their commitment.
So that's an interesting segue into my next question. You know, you spoke about your relationship and how you make all your colleagues feel important because you are able to give spend a lot of time with them and you are listening to them. But I've heard the similar feedback from parents, from students, and more importantly, from your staff. You know, that, you know, whether it was the watchman or a very, very senior parent, when Bob Hetzel speaks to me, he is with me at that particular point of time. Yeah. What is that philosophy or what is that secret?
Well, you know, it's one, a belief, in a belief that I articulated pretty regularly, and that each of us is part of something greater than our individual contribution, and no one's contribution is greater than anyone else's. Yeah. And so I would, so I think that was it, quite frankly, that when a parent came to me, they knew that I was going to listen to what they had to say. I might not be able to do what they asked, but they knew that they would be heard. And if I couldn't do it, they knew that I would explain to them why that was not a possibility or it couldn't be done now. And the same with, and the other thing I think helped was, I have a motto: there are no surprises and there are no secrets at AAS. And so the important thing for me was that I had an ongoing dialogue with, so I met regularly with students, I met regularly with faculty representatives, I met regularly with the officers from our parent association, and I met with members of the staff on a regular basis. And so we were always in touch with one another about any potential issues that existed out there, any hopes that people had or aspirations. And so there never was, so there literally were no big surprises. And in fact, I said, sometimes it'll be timing. Sometimes you may be the last to know, but you will know, and it won't come as a big surprise. And I think that that creates an atmosphere of openness and trust that, again, people feel they are part of something larger than themselves and their contribution.
And at what stage of your life did you develop this philosophy of openness and trust, or was it always there?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think some of it came from really great experiences, great role models. And I think of my first teaching position and working in an environment with a principal who really trusted us 100%. And then also there is that learning that, you know, from the beginning of my career, I was involved in getting a master's degree at, you know, at night. And so reading about people who were successful and what were those qualities that they had, and that in engendering trust is something that I read over and over. And then again, experiencing what it's like to work in a school where there's a where there's openness, where we sat together, and how that made me feel. And so when I got to be became a principal, I said I want to practice that. And then it's part of it is learning processes that you can use to engage 50 people in a conversation, processes you can use to gather feedback. So I'm sure Vera said at AES, we did a lot of feedback surveys to the community, to the faculty, to the staff. And in fact, I remember there was a slogan back when in the 70s that feedback is the breakfast of champions. And I think, I guess that's how I did it, through my learning and through experience.
Very interesting. So let me take this a little further. You know, when there is trust and honesty, there is also a whole aspect of vulnerability. If I make myself vulnerable to you, and you make yourself vulnerable to me, that means I tend to share much more.
Yes.
Would that be a part of your thinking? Because you're also a director.
Yes. You know, that's a very good point. Because one of the challenges of a school director is, who do I get to talk to about some of my anxieties? And to me, that's the value of executive coaching.
Correct.
And so even though I had a long history as a school administrator, probably the most constructive thing I've done for myself was have an executive coach. Okay. And because there is there are vulnerabilities or that I don't think it's fair to share with others, I'm there to help them be strong and not worry. And I'll say, why should all of us worry? That's my job.
Yeah.
And so there are some things that you're absolutely very insightful on that. There's an obvious vulnerability in that you're sharing ideas and you're thinking about issues. But there is probably a line that you don't want to cross.
Correct. Absolutely. So one more question on AES before I move to the next part of our program. You know, I believe when you retired, all male teachers had grown a mustache like yours.
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
Well, you know, obviously, I was really touched. And I think what has gotten me, what really touches me is the fact that just because I treat people respectfully and with concern, that they respond with such affection. It seems to me that should be going on with everybody, everywhere, all the time.
Correct.
And it shouldn't be something that you should be singled out for in adoration. But it was very, very touching. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. Other than it was not unusual as winter was coming that the male members would decide to have a beard
with
contest.
November coming in.
But this was not November.
I agree. So, you know, moving on to education in India, you know, you've observed India for 18 years, for a very large part as director of AES, and then you consulted here. And then you're a teacher, so I'm sure you're always seeing what's going on. What is the difference that you see in the educational system in the U.S. and in India?
Well, I would say the single biggest difference is that in India, every child is taught what the right answer is. And there's no question there is one right answer. And in the American system, children are taught what is the right question? And that there are many possible answers in with some problems. And so I think in India, because of the board system, that 12th grade board exam is such high stakes.
I agree.
That the focus has to be on, we've got to get that right. And so the concept of a national exam is very different from the US, where the emphasis is on the state control and local control of schools. And so parents, and that's the other thing, parents have a tremendous influence on the school their child attends. And just like AES, they have a tremendous difference.
True. But, you know, yes, you're absolutely right that there is a need, there is a requirement in India to have the right answer. And yet, there are a lot of successful people coming out of the Indian system.
Oh, heavens, yes.
And, you know, very often I talk to our own sons, and they said that when they left India and moved overseas, they had to unlearn a lot of the things because the system of education and working was different. What do you think can be done to change at least some parts of India?
Well, you know, there are two fundamental questions that every school or school system, whether it be a national system or a local system, have to answer. And one question is, in what way will we all be alike so it benefits our students? And the other question is, in what way will we all be different so it benefits our students? And what I believe in India that usually the question, in what way will we all be alike, one of them should be that we all have equal access to resources. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a level playing field. And the second one usually has to do with the values of certain content areas. For instance, mm-hmm. the U.S., every child's going to get, at some point, they will not graduate from high school if they don't have a course in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. So that's an area we'll all be alike in. And I think one of the struggles in India, and actually talking to some college professors, is that there's so much centralized control over the content, mm-hmm. it's very hard to change it.
Correct.
And so I think my own belief is that giving greater autonomy to states, probably, to manage the content, and with that will come changes in methodology. And at the same time, if you look at the strength of India, I mean, India is filled with brilliant people. Mm-hmm. And I think that, well, I think the independent schools here do a marvelous job. They still have that 12 standard exam, but just like the International Baccalaureate is now part of almost every independent school. Yeah. So they seem to have a degree of independence mm-hmm. that government schools don't. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So here, you know, you spoke about, you know, the private schools, but the largest number of Indian children are in government schools. Mm-hmm. And I remember when, you know, I was much younger, in the late 50s, early 60s, literacy in India was at about 52%. I was reading some statistics yesterday, and I think we are a little over 82% now. And yet I keep hearing that despite these numbers, Indians can't read, Indians can't write, a lot of Indian children can't, I shouldn't generalize, can't, you know, express themselves. You spoke about state education. I find some states saying we will now start teaching in the local language. I mean, what, as an observer from outside, as someone who has spent so much time, what is happening in education in our country that seems to be going all over the place for the poor? There is this very small, mm-hmm. Creamy layer that seems to get all the opportunities.
Yes.
That's true.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And so your question is, what is happening that some people are not having equal access to a good education? And, you know, and I'm surely not any expert on Indian education.
Sure.
But again, it's not unlike the U.S., or not just the U.S., but any country in the world. So much of the quality of schooling mm-hmm. is based on socioeconomics, that somehow the children from families that have more are going to end up in schools that have better teachers, sometimes more resources. And there also is a cultural dimension about the value of schooling mm-hmm. that, again, parents have to support their, well, my good example is a friend of mine, her driver's son, his grandfather thinks he should not be going to school, he should mm-hmm. be out in the fields. Mm-hmm. The number of families who think girls really don't need much education. Correct. And I think all those things work against poor children. Mm-hmm. And that's hard for a school to overcome, quite frankly. Kids have to be motivated. Mm. And the other thing I've heard from talking to a number of Indian educators, of course, is that you have to have some control over the quality of teaching. Mm. And in a government school, it's very difficult that if you have a teacher who is not committed, who's not even showing up, to get rid of that teacher.
Okay, so moving to another question, just before we started chatting on camera, we were speaking about failure. And a lot of Indian students, a lot of Indian children, are never taught the meaning of failure. And yet, in the startup or entrepreneurial world in the Bay Area, if you fail, you're considered to be a hero because you've learned.
Right.
What is your interpretation of failure? And how do you think we can imbibe in children that failure is not bad? I mean, we see children taking extreme steps, and I often wonder why.
Well, it's interesting because right now, in the one of the dominant themes in educational psychology is resilience.
Okay.
That there's a professor named Duckworth that has done a lot of research in saying the children who succeed have this quality of resilience. And it's really saying, well, I failed, but I'm going to try harder. Or can I figure out what I need to do next? And so I had a couple of thoughts about it. One is that children need to be exposed to, I mean, literally taught that here are some people, let's give them some examples of people who have failed. And they're, and in the U.S., that's done pretty regularly, especially with inventors. Abraham Lincoln, our most famous president, the only election he ever won was president.
Wow.
He lost every other election he ever ran for. And so you try to see that. You try to put up role models. They love using Michael Jordan, probably the greatest basketball player ever, who said that he missed the winning shot 50% of the time. He said, I'm a 50% failure. And he said, but I show up at the next game and I say, I'll take that shot again. And so I think one of the things is, like I work with a group of children, and one of the things I emphasize to them is practice, practice, practice. Because for me, failure is the disappointment of not achieving a goal. An anticipated outcome, and you didn't achieve it. And you have to step back and say, what could I have done differently? And so much of my own example, and also I begin to look at them not as failures, but mistakes. And almost without exception, most of the mistakes I made, I would say were due to the fact if I would have talked to one more person and gotten one more person's outlook and advice, or if I'd have given myself one more day, I probably would have avoided that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So, Bob, a few more questions on you personally. You said that, you know, your father told you about getting, making sure you had a job that got you to wear a tie, a white shirt. And then you said here you had an executive coach. So, therefore, there have been some mentors. What have been your learnings from your mentors?
Say that again.
What have been your learnings from your mentors?
From my mentors? Oh, there are a lot of them. Probably the biggest learnings, one of the biggest influences in my thinking was really an opportunity to spend some time with Peter Senge from MIT. And the introduction of systems and systems thinking, how interconnected everything is, and the fact that the impact of decisions is often far in terms of distance and time. And so that whole idea that of complexity, that I see, when I see some administrators falter, it's due to a lack of appreciation of the complexity of things. I think a second was the concept of the political nature of leadership, that and politics in the very best sense of that word, it's really about relationships. And that relationships are so important to trying to achieve any goal that you're going to do, because you're not in an organization, you're not going to achieve something alone. It's going to be with others. And again, the value of one of my mentors used to say, no one is smarter than all of us. And so it's that notion of collective intelligence, and that an SA mentor said, it's much better to wait and be the last to speak than the first, because you'll learn a lot waiting.
Correct.
And so those are small, not small things, but those all have been things that have shaped me. And then I would say those are some of the main.
Very interesting. So Bob, my last question to you, and I ask this from every guest who I speak to, what has been your biggest learning from your failures?
Well, probably the biggest learning for me is the notion that this too shall pass. That no matter what the magnitude of the failure, it too will pass. Mm-hmm. It too will become history. Mm-hmm. And what I need to do is look straight ahead and start taking the next step to recover from it. Whatever the failure is, but not to allow it to think somehow this is so devastating that it can't be surmounted ever. And it's back to our discussion, that time passes, and with it, people's memories fade over, especially over organizational mistakes. That's probably the biggest learning I had was.
That's amazing.
This too is going to pass.
This too shall pass. Yeah. Thank you. Bob, thank you very much. That's been an absolutely incredible chat I've had with you.
Well, thank you.
Your words of wisdom will be heard by thousands of people. But I wish you lots of good health and lots of success.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.